Jim, I think you said some further words. K3JIW, K2LIW in the second end.
Okay, Scott's a friend of mine, by the way. E3JIW back. I believe that the fancy plug has a plastic sleeve arrangement that springs out, and it actually covers up those bare blades, so even little fingers couldn't touch them. The fancy plug pushes this tube arrangement down, allowing me prongs to stand proud. So, yeah, you could buy stuff that can be hanging in the wind and safe, and I'll pass it back to Ned. It's an interesting night.
Fantastic. Awful glad that these two friends, Jim and Scott, signed in. Yes, I vaguely remember seeing that. I'm unhappy that I didn't remember it. So, therefore, my gender bender extension cord with male on both ends can be made safe. I like it. And I can put a 240-volt connector on the outside of the house and make it simpler to use my 240-volt generator. It's getting better and better. So taking apart my fuse panel and putting in that jumper, which I feel rather uncomfortable when I'm doing it. I'm doing it with a flashlight. Everything's turned off. I'm disconnected from my main power source in the outside world. I still feel very uncomfortable putting in that jumper, if you know what I mean. And I know I'm bending the rules like crazy. John, KC2WGB, go right ahead. K2RIW in the tech net.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick, those things are available. One company is Appleton, and the other one would be Hubble Chance. They both make those exact things up to 100 amps at least. So there's no problem, and they are. They have little shutters. Some of them have cube blocks that recess as you press them together. Some have a shutter arrangement on them. They're a little expensive, a little pricey, but they're totally safe. Use them all the time.
Okay, we're slowly coming around to a safer way of using our generator outside of the house. And as I've told you guys, for the first 10 or so years that I lived in this house, let me think, up until Hurricane Gloria, 1985, from 1970, 15, 16 years, for the first 16 years, I lived, whenever I had a power outage of any extensive period of time, I lived on a 1,500-watt generator. Granger, 1,500-watt, yucky generator, nothing great, bare-bones machine, 1,500-watt stand, a continuous 1,800-watt surge, and I ran the whole darn house on it, oil-fired hot water heater, oil-fired furnace, refrigerator, a small refrigerator, not a huge refrigerator, television set, a couple of light bulbs, and occasionally I would turn the light on out in front of the house to let everybody know that I had electricity. Back in the days of 1970 when this first occurred, and motor generators in people's backyards were kind of rare. I was a little bit of a braggart on that one. And ham radio, of course, I got onto too. So I had all the creature comforts. I had a warm house. I could take a shower. I had food that wasn't spoiling. I had television and lights. What else? But I had to be the power czar. If everything went on at once, as occasionally it did, the generator would stall. And I would turn off at least one of those appliances, restart the generator, and then control it. So 1,500 watts can do it. The next generator, the ones that we bought 500 and some odd for the Airborne Instruments Laboratory, were 4,000 watts. And now, power-wise, I thought I was in hot city, fat city, because, let me drop. That 4,000-watt generator with electric start, a little bit on the heavy side, 155 pounds, so bringing it out of my basement into the backyard was a two-person operation. One single guy that doesn't want to break his back really shouldn't be doing that. And if I had a big enough garage and a set of wheels on it, that should be kept in the garage in its own little cubby hole somewhere and wheel it out to the backyard. But don't run a generator in the garage. People try to do that. Be very careful with the way you wire it. And 4,000 watts is more than enough from my point of view. Now I don't even have to play power czar. And because it's a 220-volt output generator, if I wire things, 240 volts, if I wire things correctly, I can even run the electric range as long as I don't turn on too many burners at once or turn on the oven and the broiler simultaneously, if you know what I mean. So you have essentially all of the creature comforts, except you've got to be a little bit careful as to how many things you turn on at once. Now, there are people talking about buying a generator. They want to make double darn sure they've got enough power. Let me drop. And they go out and buy a 10, 12, 15-kilowatt generator. There's at least three disadvantages of doing that. Number one, a hell of a lot more dollars on a machine that's going to be used 0.01% of the time of the use of your house. Yes, it's very vital during those 1 or 2 days when you really need it. But it's something that's going to be used a very low percentage of the time, and you're spending a lot of bucks on it. Number two, because it's a much bigger object, it's much heavier, much more subject to being difficult to move from point A to point B. And number three, when the majority of the time your house is running a very light load, the average personal house rarely goes beyond 1 or 2 kilowatts of average drain. So most of the time you're going to be running in the 1.5 kilowatt region, and you've got this machine capable of 12 kilowatts sitting out there, and he's burning up fuel in the idling mode twice as fast, and therefore you're going to be running back with the gas cans to the gas line. And there were, you guys in Canada didn't have that problem, but down here on Long Island, there were people waiting for 3 and 4 hours on a line to get gas for their can or gas for their automobile, and they started off at 3 o'clock in the morning to get ahead of the crowd. There was a shortage of petroleum down here like you wouldn't believe, and it's taken a week and a half, and we're just slowly getting out from under it because it's a very long pipeline, so to speak, and somebody put a great big bubble in the pipeline, technically speaking, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. Which means that if you're selecting a generator, although they're very rare, it's worth considering buying a diesel-powered generator. And I can think of 2 or 3 reasons that you get a benefit from doing that. Number one, you go to the right gas station that has a thoroughly separate diesel fuel pump. You don't stand on line. I saw lots of people fueling up their diesel automobile, and there was no line. In fact, a number of the gas stations I went to were out of gasoline, but they still had diesel. And there was no waiting to fill up a diesel vehicle. And if I was filling up a diesel container for my diesel-powered generator, there'd be no line. Number two, storing diesel fuel, no matter where you store it around your property, is a hell of a lot safer. If by mistake you spill some of it, it's not going to suddenly catch on fire. To burn diesel fuel, you have to literally vaporize it first. If you took a cup of diesel fuel and a match in your hand, a lit match, and you plunge the match into the cup of diesel fuel, I believe it would put out the match. You do that with gasoline, and wow, you got a lot of trouble. So it's a much safer fuel. The price of the fuel is about the same. Yes, you could even tap into your oil tank for your house to power the generator. Safe fuel, easily available fuel, and slightly more exotic generator. So it's worth considering. It's not a cure-all, but it has certain advantages that are worth considering. And with any further questions or comments on all of the above, give me your call letters right now. K2LIW in the tech chat.
K2RMX.
WGB with a comment.
This is November 2, Tango Echo Hotel. Good evening, Dick. And how about propane?
Okay, Tango Echo Hotel and KZ2WGB are the ones that I heard immediately, and there was other doubles in there. The generator that we bought for Airborne Instruments Laboratory, 500 some odd of them, was a triple fuel generator. It would run on liquid propane, natural gas, or gasoline, and the regulator to use it on natural gas was supplied with the generator. So that was a triple fuel generator. You had to worry a little bit about the fact that when you ran it on natural gas, the energy content was lower, so the 4-kilowatt generator probably turned out only 3 kilowatts, and it was a little bit harder to start. But so running it on natural gas has certain advantages. In theory, it's an infinite supply that's always there. That's the good news. However, you take a place like Breezy Point, Long Island, off of the, is that Brooklyn or Queens County, I'm not sure which, but Breezy Point, Long Island, where 105 houses burned all at once. I'm reasonably sure they turned off the gas in that community for many days at a time. So for safety reasons, when houses are burning down and they turn off the gas and you're running on natural gas, that could be a problem. You have a little bit more reliability from my point of view if the fuel to run your generator is something that you own. Now, I know there were some doubles in there, The next guy that I could hear easily was John, KC2WGB. Go right ahead, John. I'll pick up the doubles right after John. Don't worry.
KC2WGB. Dick, one thing I wanted to mention, which people have to realize, if they're going to take the convenient way of using that gender cord and plug into an outlet on the outside of the house, no matter what size that extension cord is, no problem. But they're back feeding on a number 12 wire. They really can't exceed 20 amperes unless they go to the dryer, which is usually a number 10 wire. They could put 220 there at 30 amperes. So they got to be careful. You had the best idea. Go directly to the panel with a back breaker, back feed the panel, turn the main off. So that's just a note that if they buy a 4kW generator, they're not going to be able to plug that into the outlet on the outside of the house. Just thought I'd mention that. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Good point, John. John has spent the last 20 or so years of his life wiring some very high power, designing and wiring some very high power systems for military applications. So, yes, there's another disadvantage of buying a humongous generator. The way you conveniently feed your house, unless you have a specifically designed transfer relay with a very specifically designed high power cord going from that point to the generator, you can't use a 10 kilowatt generator. 10 kilowatts at 120 volts, for instance, would be, let me think, is that 100 amperes? Yeah, I think it's 100 amperes. Yes. No normal outlet on your house is going to take anywhere near 100 amperes. So another disadvantage of buying a big generator. As I see it, during the few days of the decade that you need independent power, you don't have to live in the lap of luxury. You can be doing a little bit of camping out in your house. You can be living a little bit more Spartan. But if the house is warm and you've got hot water where you can take a shower, you've got a refrigerator that keeps your food, you've got some way of heating the food, and you've got a television set so you can find out what's going on in the outside world, and you got some lights you can turn on, that's all you really need. You can sit there and complain about the fact that some of the other luxuries are not there, but you're sitting there a hell of a lot better than the rest of the world that's got nothing, because they ain't got a generator, and all they're finding out is every time, if the telephone works, you call up your local power company and try to get an answer as to when is the power going to be restored, and most of the time you can't get an answer because they don't know. In my case, I got fiber, Verizon, telephone, and internet connection. The good news is that internet connection stayed operative because that particular line between me and the central office didn't go down. That's the good news. The bad news is that between the audio handpiece of my telephone inside the house and that fiber is a chunk of electronics that converts my audio into an optical signal. That circuit requires power. It's got a standby battery. The standby battery is good for something like 8 hours. So after 8 hours of no power, I have no telephone. Lots of other people had thought they're saving $1 zillion because they now had the internet telephone, Vonage or whatever it was, or in some cases they had cable television telephone. And because the cable television system, if it's a RF cable system, which has 14 amplifiers per mile, and every darn one of those amplifiers during every darn one of those miles must be powered. And each of those amplifiers, in general, are being powered by the local utility pole that's nearest that particular amplifier. So when various utility poles go down, the cable system goes down. Yes, you have no cable television, and if you chosen cable television, cable-type telephone, you have no telephone. From my point of view, that ain't good. That's a safety item. Lots of people thought they're going to get around this because they got a cell phone. However, I don't think more than 3% of the people with a cell phone were smart enough to buy the cigarette lighter charger. You got that automobile sitting in the driveway. Let me drop it. The automobile is sitting in the driveway with this humongous 12-volt battery, which has the ability to charge 200 cell phones, and I'm not kidding. It's got the energy to charge a whole lot of cell phones. And I don't think 3% of the population owned that cigarette lighter charger. How in the world did they allow that to happen? I'm guessing that the owner's manual didn't tell them that it's an inexpensive item that they should buy. It didn't come in the box when they bought the cell phone. Therefore, they don't know about it. Of my friends that own a cell phone, I've asked them on multiple occasions, how many spare batteries do you have for your cell phone? And they say, what is that? I said, what happens if your battery goes dead? Well, I charge it. Well, how do you charge it if there's no local power and you don't own the cigarette lighter charger for your automobile? And they say, what's that? I mean, we ham radio operators with handy talkies know about spare batteries. The majority of cell phone people do not. And even if they charge the cell phone, probably one-third of all the cell sites, after 8 hours, their batteries went dead because they had no standby generator. It's only the high-priority cell sites that are near a convention center or near a major manufacturing area that have a standby generator on the cell site. So even once you charge the cell phone, you think you've got reliable communication. You might not, because the cell site itself may go down. Lots of things to consider, as you can tell. There was another person who tried to sign in. Please give me your call letters one more time. KQ and name, KQRIW in the TechNet. I know there was at least one other person that doubled and I didn't pick him up. Who was that?
Call, please.
Okay, you said call, please. There is a net in progress, the technical net. Do you think you've got an emergency? Go right ahead, sir.
No emergency. I just wanted to comment on the cell phone and the generator conversation. That was pretty much it. I can't say too long. I just wanted to throw my two cents in.
Okay. Please give us a set of call letters and a name, and please give us your wisdom, sir. Go right ahead. K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Hello, Dick. How you doing? The handle here is Gig. That's Golf, and you Golf. The call sign is November 2, Golf. India Golf. And, I don't know if it's wisdom or not, but reference the cell sites and the backup power. Over 80% of the Verizon Wireless cell sites do have backup power. A combination of natural gas, one or two might be propane, and the majority of them are diesel. None of the other carriers have backup generators on site. They have to be trucked in. And most of the problems that we had during a storm is that the telco muxes, where we get our T1s, or EPH circuits in this case, are not powered and anything, and their batteries are old and they don't work.
So it sounds like you probably work for that company, Gabe. Good to know. And maybe you're one of the guys that maintains those cell sites from C-Target where you live. Of the cell sites that do have, I think you said 80% of them have generator backup, and I guess some of those are diesel-fired. Make me a rough guess, Gig. The diesel oil supply for the generator would maintain one of those cell sites for how long? Would it keep the cell site running continuously for 4 days if an oil delivery was impossible because of downed trees and unavailable oil? Into GIG, K2RIW and the TechNet.
It actually depends on how busy the site is, but the minimum amount of time up that a cell site would stay on the air was 3 days. We've had, believe it or not, on sites that aren't that busy, we've had sites, believe it or not, lasting upwards of 5 days, 5 to 6 days running 24/7 on diesel fuel. And that's a 250 some odd gallon tank. Some of them vary, 250, 100 gallons, some of them are 110, that bit. There might be some that are more than that, but most of our generators are about 250. And we have a company that runs around and fuels them all. We actually did pretty well. There were a lot of sites that were down, and most of the sites were down because we had no telco, no EVH circuits, no T1s to run cell sites. So that's where that went. So you had a big hefty generator running a dumb cell site that didn't go anywhere.
interesting, Jake. Wow. Yeah, so you're saying that of the cell sites that have a backup diesel generator, something in the vicinity of 5 days' worth of oil probably is available, 3 to 5 days' worth. So if an oil delivery doesn't take place on day number 6 or 7, the cell site itself goes down. However, we keep forgetting about the fact that the cell sites are interwired with T1 lines. And if the T1 line fails because of breakage, flooding, or whatever, then the cell site's got nothing to talk to. It would sure be nice to dream about a cell site system, a cell phone system, where microwave links were interlinking the individual cell sites. Of course, this is a dream. If the cell sites were all located on top of mountains, you could do that. But some of them are in microwave-wise, not-so-reliable locations where they can easily get line of sight between them. But give me a couple of words on that, though. Is there any backup to the T1 line? If the T1 line connected to a cell site, and maybe it's a pair of T1 lines, but you know what I mean. If that fails, of course, the cell site can't communicate with anything except other customers of that particular region. They can talk to each other, but they can't talk to the outside world. Is there a backup to the T1 line on critical sites, at Greg? N2GIG, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Actually, I'm probably dating myself. Most of the sites don't even use T1s anymore. With the new 4G and everything else, they use EVH circuits, which are 100 meg circuits. But basically, for this conversation, we can say that it's not the same thing, but it does the same thing, if that makes any sense. And sadly to say, no. A lot of the sites in the old days ran. Sometimes we had sites that would have 10, 15, 20 T1s in them, believe it or not. Now each site has one EVH circuit, Ethernet backhaul circuit, at 100 meg. If it goes down, so does the cell site. Sometimes previously, if you had a T1, yeah, you lose one or two T1s, you lose a couple of carriers. But now, your eggs are sort of all in one basket. You lose one EVH circuit. Well, each site has one. You lose one, you lose the lot. You lose everything, which is what happened.
W2OYY. Joe recognized. Let me go back to Greg here for a second. The EBH, Ethernet backhaul circuit, I'm guessing that in many cases is fiber. And if I asked you, is there backup to the fiber, I'm going to guess it might not be. However, for the fiber for the EBH to have reliability, it has the equivalent of a central office somewhere, and multiple ones of those, which have to be properly powered. So from your point of view, with your experience, Jake, what do you believe is the reliability of the EBH circuits that wire in between the cell sites? I'm guessing that occasionally they have an interruption. There's a break in that chain, and therefore that cell site can talk to the local region but may not be able to talk to the outside world. That's a bunch of guesses on my part. N2GIG, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, Dick, in my experiences, I have found that the EBA circuits basically are 1,000,000,000 times more reliable than any T1 ever was. But sadly, like I said, if you lose your EBA circuit, there goes everything. There's only one per site. In the old days, you had a lot of T1s in one site. Now, with the... and you are right, it is fiber. When you lose that, you lose everything. So it's sort of kind of like putting your eggs in one basket, so to speak. But like I said, I just wanted to throw that in there. I think I heard Joe in. I'm not sure if there's anybody else. I will throw it back to you, and thanks for entertaining me. I appreciate it. And to
WGIJ. WGB would have commented.
Okay, we got Joe.
Oh, my wife.
We got Joe and John in that order. Jake, one more thing. The EBH circuit, all of the electronics of the cell site has to be converted into a optical signal that goes into the fiber. In theory, that should be a very reliable circuit backed up by its own UPS and batteries and whatever. Have you ever seen a failure of that circuit that goes between the cell site and the fiber, the EBH? Is that a circuit that has five nines of reliability, so to speak, from your point of view, Gig, N2GIG, K2LIW?
Not in my experience, is actually that is pretty reliable, but you know what, anything can happen. But for the most part, it is pretty reliable.
Okay, it's very reliable. Does each cell site only have one of those interfaces? Or would it cost too much, or is it just something that hasn't been considered? Is there a backup to that interface between the electronics of the cell site and the optical fiber? Is there a backup on that one, or is all the eggs in one basket at the average cell site? N2GIG, K2LIW?
K2RIW, N2GIG, yeah, each site only has one. In our case, the way we have it configured, one site only has one circuit. And if it goes, so then the entire site does as well. It's not like the old days where you had 10, 5, you know, 15 T1s, for crying out loud. You could lose one or two T1s, and it, you know, the site would still stay in here. It wouldn't be the end of the world. But you lose the EBH circuit from the, you know, from telco to us to inside the cell site. Yeah, site's down. End of story.
Okay, well, we're on that one. How expensive is that thing? If that was $30,000, I can certainly see economically you're not going to have two of them, one in hot standby, so to speak. But if that is a piece of $200 worth of electronics, it seems a little bit silly not to have a backup. What's your very rough guess, if you happen to know, Gig? How expensive is that EBH interface? N2GIG, K2LIW?
That's a good question. That I do not know. I don't know. That's something that's pretty interesting, you know, something I probably should have thought of. But I'll ask around, and next time, I'll mention to you, or I'll send you an email or something, but I'm curious about that too now.
Oh, these hams, they get into all kinds of crazy places, Gig. Hey, Joe, straighten us out on all this. The B2RYY, K2RIW, and then John, right after you. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I just want to make a quick comment, Dick. When the cell site, because I worked in the advanced industry for many, many years, when the cell site loses connection with the switch for, you know, whatever reason, it does not even make mobile to mobile calls. It can't make mobile to landline or mobile to mobile calls. It's totally off the air. It's gone. It must keep the connection to the switch to operate correctly. So, the cell site may have electric at the cell site, but if you lose the connection to the switch, you're up the creek.
Is that because of the very elaborate synchronization that's required, Joe? W2RYY, K2RYW?
Well, basically, Dick, the cell site is told what to do from the switch. It processes calls, but it processes calls by handling the communication between itself and the switch. And the switch does the connecting to the battery's front and so forth to direct the calls accordingly. So it loses that direction. It's pretty much isolated by itself. It can't really do anything by itself. QGZ.
QGZ, you're going to be right after John. Hang in there, Rich. Oh, my goodness. John, KC2WG, go right ahead.
KC2WGB. Dick, I think what we're trying to do here is give basic instructions for these generator considerations. I think the first thing people should do, which you spoke about last week, they should get their priorities. What do they want to operate? Mark those breakers so that when they do power up their panel, they know maybe they have an outlet in the kitchen that they want. Find out what breaker that is. And then they can selectively turn on or load shed as they want. Then they should also pick a place to place the generator. It should be on level ground. They should be reminded that if it's a generator on wheels, it has to be chopped, and it should not be any flammable shrubs, things like that. There's so much to consider, but now is the time to do it when it's fresh in their mind and the weather is still conducive to going out and doing these kind of things. So there's a lot of little tips that they should start on now if they're really considering the generator. Get their ducks in a row, and they can make a good decision. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Hey, you brought up some very good points, John. So for the people who are about to go out and buy generators, and Bernie wants us to cover that subject, among many other people who have been communicating with me, tell us more about generators. Where are you going to locate it? Is it far enough from the house? Right kind of extension cord, the right kind of a way of powering up whatever you're going to power in the house. And there's essentially two approaches there. An extension cord that goes through a window or a door and powers just particular things that you plug into the extension cord. That's the super safe way to do it, but it's a bit of a pain because that technique will give you refrigerator and television set and some lights, but it's not going to give you the furnace and the hot water heater because that requires significant rewiring or backfiring at the house. I suspect among us electronic enthusiasts that a high percentage of the people are going to, by one means or another, they're going to power the wiring of the house, whether it be the A and the B circuit or just the A circuit or the B circuit. But that's what I think the majority are going to do. And let me drop
One more point, Dick.
I was on the phone with a few of my buddies today, and I was asking them, do you know which of the circuit breakers power which portion of the house and what appliances? And the average guy has a couple of notes on the little matrix piece of paper that's on the cover of the circuit breaker panel, which tells them something, that this circuit breaker sort of covers the living room and a little bit of the dining room, so to speak, and there's a lot more you want to find out about along these lines. So which circuit breakers? Now, I didn't have to flip on enough circuit breakers. First of all, I don't have circuit breakers. I got cartridge fuses. But I didn't have to unscrew the fuses because all I had to do was control the people. In other words, by way of the red switch on the stairs going to the oil burner, I could turn up the oil burner if it decided to turn on hot water heater, oil burner, and refrigerator simultaneously, install the old 1,500-watt generator. So I just flipped that switch. So I didn't have to do circuit breaking. I powered the whole house. I just controlled the people to make sure they didn't fire everything. That worked for me. Maybe with you, you have less control of the people, and you got to do it in a more severe manner by turning off that particular circuit breaker. But there's lots of things to consider. But what else do you want to add to this one, John, before we go over the bill? KC2WGB, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Well, your furnace, whether it be oil-fired or gas-fired, by code has to be on its own breaker. So that's usually easy to find. And if you are wiring your house up for this, you know that breaker, you close that, your heat's going to run. And it really doesn't draw that much. I don't even think most of them have a quarter horsepower motor on them. So that's relatively nothing. So if they know that breaker, when they do that backfeed wiring, they click that breaker on, the heat's going to run. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, I think it's the right way to do it. I really think in the big picture, backfiring the house, backfeeding the house, once you have enough electronic knowledge and you know the risk involved, is the easiest way to go. I've talked to people who try to do everything on a single extension cord from the generator going into the house where it feeds refrigerator and some lights and maybe the television set. And then they do some kind of hokey rewiring of the furnace in order to power it into the extension cord. I think that's getting a little too deep. I think at that threshold, it's time to flip over to backfeeding the house. And lots of people have lost a tremendous amount of sleep saying that when I backfeed the house, all the circuit breakers are not going to work right. Does it matter? Even though you're feeding the circuit breakers backwards, you have a very finite source of current at the generator. And if you bought the right generator, there is a circuit breaker at the generator. That gives you the protection. The fact that you're using your circuit breakers of the main fuse panel of the house in the reverse mode, stop worrying about it. Because they're there to protect you from the 4,000 amperes that Con Ed is capable of delivering to you. Your generator has only got 1% of that. Stop worrying. Mr. QTZ, I know that you live in Massapequa. I know that Massapequa was hit hard. Thank goodness, I know you're north of Sunrise Highway. Therefore, you're not in the Zone A flood. Hopefully, you did a lot better, but I'll bet you some of your neighbors are suffering. Mr. QG's at KQLAW. Go ahead, Bill. Figuring out exactly what you said did require some mental processing. Dave, going to go to you right after John. John came before you. KC2WGB, K2LAW. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Dick, I just wanted to mention that you're only reverse feeding one breaker. If it's a 15-amp breaker or 20-amp breaker, you're going to put 110 volts into your panel, fine. If you're going to use a two-pole breaker, you're going to backfeed it with 220 volts. All the other breakers are going to operate normally. You're not going to be reverse feeding them. They're connected to those two main buses, so you're all right with that.
Good point. Very good point. So only one breaker, the particular circuit that you're backfeeding, is the only one that's being fed in reverse. And I've heard all kinds of stories as to a circuit breaker fed in reverse. Is it giving you proper protection? Is it giving you GFI protection and proper maximum current protection? And depending on brand name and how it's being used, there was some doubt about that. But I think it's not something to lose a lot of sleep over, because you've got a very finite generator that cannot issue 4,000 amperes, so stop worrying. And the rest of the house is circuit broken. And if you really worry about that, make sure there's a circuit breaker at the generator. And now, from my point of view, you're as protected as you were before, even though you're backfeeding. Let's see, Dave, you go next. N2TEH, K2RIW. What's new in Warwick? You got it, Dave.
Okay, very good, Dick. N2TEH returning. Yeah, well, one good alternative fuel for generators would be to get a conversion kit for a gas generator to burn propane, LP gas, where you could get it delivered. The only problem with that is of course, the tank does have to be grounded, those huge bottle gas tanks, and you have quite a bit of fuel. See, I have a small generator here, and fortunately for myself up here in Warwick, we were without power for 1 hour in our development here, in our housing development where I live, versus most of the town of Warwick, which was out for about 8 to 11 days for the most part. But yeah, we weathered the storm okay up here. A lot of trees went down. We had a few fallen houses. Neighbor's porch got wiped out. But needless to say, that's the kind of thing that's par for the course with these kind of storms. But I do have a small generator myself. I have a little 1,200-watt camping generator. It's got a 16-amp. It's 16 amps, 1,200 watts. That's pretty good. But one thing, too, I think a lot of people fail to overlook in weather like this, before we get it, is they don't really even need a generator so long as they have a car. They can go out and buy a heavy-duty power inverter, and that would even help in a temporary situation. Over.
Yes, I've heard about that possibility, Dave, that there's a way of modifying the wiring of a 100-ampere alternator, and there's ways of forcing it to give you 120 volts AC, although I suspect you're going to get 1 kilohertz of sine wave as opposed to 60 hertz. And many appliances in the house will be happy with that. The television set, a light bulb, your ham radio rig being fed into a much higher frequency, no problem. When it comes to a rotary machine like a compressor of a refrigerator, or the rotary, the 60 cycle powered motor for the blower of your furnace, and the hot water heater and so on, there I think the frequency being that wrong could give you some grief. The computer, by the way, another thing I'm running into, which is a slightly side panel here we got to talk about, and that is a high percentage of the hams I talk to who are running on generator power, let me drop, wanted to run their internet computer. And that was being powered, as it has been for the last zillion years, on a UPS. And I'm hearing tremendous numbers of complaints of a UPS that does not like generator power. And the UPS continuously cycles back and forth between the active and the inactive mode every 2 seconds. And each time it does that, it's making a glitch. It makes a spike of some kind. And so you get that thing spiking hours on end, and a significant number of people, I'm one of them, had a computer failure because of the UPS cycling on generator power. And now, what is doing it is an interesting question. I've heard 3 stories on that one. The generator itself is not a highly regulated voltage output source. Your generator at sometimes puts out 132 volts, and at sometimes it puts out 109 volts. Most of of your appliances in the house are pretty happy with that. But the UPS, when it sees the voltage go to 132, or it sees it go down to anything less than 112, it thinks it's the beginning of a failure, and it flips from the inactive to the active mode. And pretty soon it realizes it wasn't a failure, and it goes back to the inactive mode. That's flipping back and forth. And so is that the problem? Is it the Hertz problem? I've heard somebody tell me he ran a very careful test of a particular APC brand name of UPS, and then when he fed it at 59.3 Hertz and below, or 63.3 Hertz and above, it flipped from the inactive to the active mode. It considered that a failure. So is it the 60 Hertz error, or is it the voltage high or low? Another person told me that if you read the manual on some of the APC brand of UPSs, let me drop, that when you open up the panel in the back, you can set some slide switches that determines its sensitivity. Apparently the factory sets it at something like 112 volts on the low side, and 128 volts or something like that on the high side, and if you exceed that window, it goes into the active mode. And that by resetting those switches, the high limit and the low limit can be made less stringent. And therefore, when you set those switches correctly, it is possible that your UPS will not continuously be cycling. But I can tell you, when you're running on generator power, you better inspect your UPSs. If they're sitting there flipping back and forth, it's only a matter of time before you're going to get a computer failure. In my case, I got a computer failure, not at the main computer itself, but I have a secondary computer that's doing the firewall system. And the firewall computer failed. And I guess in theory I could have bypassed my firewall, but I guarantee that would have gotten me into a whole lot of trouble. So there's another whole issue there of generator power and UPSs. And I don't know the answer on that one yet. Lots of theories, lots of people have run tests. I haven't yet found anybody who's happy with the way his UPS behaves on generator power. Anybody with questions or comments on the above, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Victor Echo 3, Zulu Tango Zulu.
Zulu Tango Zulu, go right ahead, Scott. Let's see, hopefully the UPSs you got there in Canada are not so persnickety. You got it, Scott.
Well, being in part of North America, we have pretty much the same brands and issues as you would down there. But we'll start with the broadside. Of it first, there are two basic categories of UPS. One is called the backup style or mode, and the other is called an online mode. In a backup, there is essentially a relay, be it solid state or mechanical, that flows utility power to your PCs. And when that utility power fades, circuitry kicks in and kicks the inverter up and pops the relay so that you're then fed by battery. And that produces the chatter that you made reference to when the line voltage is utility power is fluctuating. All backup style power supply UPSs will suffer from that. The other style of power supply is called online. I'm going to trip. An online style power UPS, the batteries are continuously engaged, the inverter is continuously on, and your PCs that are connected to it are being powered by battery. And utility power flows into a battery charger circuitry, which keeps the batteries continuously charged. But your PCs are actually being driven by the electrolytes that come out of the batteries. The online UPSs are more tolerant of being run by GenVac'd power instead of utility-backed power. I'm going to trip again. You mentioned some people removing the back covers and adjusting some sliders. I think that depends on the vintage of your UPS. Modern UPSs purchased those, say, in the last 5-7 years or so. There's a CD-ROM that typically comes with your UPS. You load that up, you install a utility, you USB connect or serial connect your PC to your UPS, whichever connection it accepts, and you could go in software and adjust those sensitivities. You do not need to remove the cover, void warranty, and play with live wires. All of those parameters are software adjustable. The E3 is at DZ back to net.
Okay. I think I heard somebody trying to sign in, but he was only there 5% of the time, so we got nothing out of that one. Hey, Scott, that's darn valuable information. Okay, so the backup UPS is what I think 95% of the population is using down here, and maybe up there with you too. So the fact that the backup type UPS, the one that goes from the active to the inactive mode when it thinks it sees a fault, the fact that it is personal computer reprogrammable, that it's got the right kind of interfacing card and you got the right piece of software, and I'm guessing it's beyond the normal user's manual you're describing, we can reset the parameters as to its sensitivity of voltage and frequency and whatever, over voltage, under voltage, and so on, sensitivity. So that's good to know. Not all of us are going to be able to do that reprogramming. It doesn't sound like it's super easy. Maybe when I send it back to you, Scott, you'll be able to tell me that somebody online gives you that information and that piece of software to do that. My next question, though, is it sounds to me like the Cadillac. Let me drop. It sounds like the Cadillac of UPS is the online type, the one that's continuously being charged. The battery is continuously being charged by the line, and the battery output is continuously running an inverter, and the computer, on all of its life, only sees the inverter output. And that's much more tolerant of glitches. That sounds good. However, now that inverter is a set of transistors continuously running. It's never in the passive mode. I worry a little bit about its reliability. And I am guessing that the online type is probably at least 50% more expensive. So give us a couple of words on the expense of the online type. If we were smart consumers, would more of us be using the online type? And the nice thing about the online type is it's continuously being charged, and as long as generator power or Long Island Lighting Company power is available, in theory, you never have a dead battery. The next thing I worry about that did happen to a couple of my friends is that the backup type that was continuously cycling, because the duty factor of cycle in the active mode versus the inactive mode, let me drop. The duty factor was high enough of the active mode versus the inactive mode while it's continuously cycling every 2 seconds, is such that in a short period of time, it killed the battery and he had nothing until he unplugged his computer from the UPS protected ports and just went over to the surge protected ports. Therefore, he was running the raw generator power straight into his computer, and at least he's back online. But as you can see, UPSs on generator power are a bit of a pain. So I guess the main thing that to tell us from your point of view, Scott, is how much more expensive is the online type? Do you think if I buy the right brand, it has enough reliability that a smart person would go in that direction? BE3, Zulu Tango Zulu, K2LAW in the SecNet. Thank you for all this information, Scott.
Well, I think the software question first. Again, it's applicable to modern uninterruptible power supplies, say 7 years coming forward to now. It's a CD-ROM. It's a Windows application. Usually in the box, and you can get updates for it from the manufacturer's web. So if you go to APC, you can download their management utility. I wouldn't say it's overly complicated. If you qualify for your ham license, mid-level or above, you should be able to follow it pretty straightforward. It's not a rocket science application, that's for sure. So it's either on the CD-ROM that came in the box, or you can get it from your manufacturer's site. And it applies to either backup or online style. As for the online style, I'm going to trip. Up here at the same, what tends to happen, at least in the Canadian marketplace, is it depends on the KVA. I don't want to say wattage because that's a misnomer, but the KVA. There tends not to be low KVA online type UPSs. They tend to be up there a bit more. And that's where the premium typically comes in. The premium for an online over a backup style at equivalent KVA and runtime is maybe 25-30%, which is not too bad. But the issue is smallest online is, you know, maybe 3 or 5 KV, whereas you can get backup style down in the 90, 100, 200, 300, 500, 1000, etc. V3Z, TZ, back to net.
Very good information, Scott. Now, once I go to APC and I download their software package that allows me to reprogram the microprocessor that's in my APC brand, for instance, of so-called backup type UPS, I think what you're telling me is I'm able to reset the upper limit and lower limit such that it's not so persnickety. If I know I'm running on generator power, I could temporarily set it so that it doesn't trip out until I hit below 103 volts on the low side and above 135 volts on the high side. I think you're telling me I could do that wide a setting on its overvoltage and undervoltage acceptability. Also, I'm not sure whether or not it also has a 60 hertz error susceptibility. In other words, where that one person told me he ran this test, and he thought that a fraction of a hertz of error on the 60 hertz would cause a false alarm. I wonder, first of all, do you think that's true, or is that just an error in information? And second of all, is that a parameter that I also can set? Can I set it in such a way that the low hertz is at 50 and the high hertz is at 70, if you know what I mean? VE3, Zulu Tango Zulu, KQLIW. Go ahead, Dave.
This is Scott at VE3ZTZ. He used my call sign and Dave's name. So I'm going to proceed because it was my call sign. On the hertz, I don't recall, and my computer is not available to me at the moment. But on the voltage settings, yes. The upper and lower range is not unlimited. It is bounded, and you can push it to the edges. How far depends on the manufacturer and, again, the quality of the components inside. But yes, you can adjust the voltage. Hertz, I'm not sure about. The other comment I wish to make about online UPS is that you put your finger right on one of the other problems people have with backup-style UPSs, is that they buy them, they plug them in, and 2.5 years later, you experience a power outage, and the lead-acid battery in a backup style is dead, and you have, like, maybe 90 seconds of runtime, and then it's gone. That will never happen in an online case. The battery is properly conditioned continuously, and your runtime, the stated runtime on an online, is what you will get out of it when it kicks over. The management software in the brain in an online is much more intelligent. So if you're going to rely on a UPS, say you have medical equipment as well connected at home. Some people have insulin pumps and things like that, kidney machines. They're all online style, or should be online style. So in a get-what-you-pay-for world, yes, the onlines are a little more expensive, mostly because they're higher KVA entry point, but they're also far more reliable, and you'll get your runtime out of them when they actually kick over. VCZTZ, back to net, and I know Jim wants in there.
Hey, Sue, YDT Mobile, the disaster relief update.
Okay, disaster relief update. Go right ahead, Matt. YDT, K2RW, you got it, Matt.
Hey, okay, very good. I just wanted to let everyone know, Nassau County, FEMA has set up a storm center with this rain too. It's at Cedar Park on Sunrise Highway. I'm just collecting Merrick Road off of Wandsville Park, Cedar Park. Also, if anyone needs any medical care, we will be having a medical level 2 mobile hospital in the Rockery at 20-52 Mott Avenue in Fort Rockery. And that'll be from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. This entire week. QYDG, back to that.
Okay, Matt, thank you for that information. Does anybody need a fill on the information that Matt just gave us? Give me your call letters right now. Okay. Scott, I'm sorry I called you, Dave. You brought up a very good point, and that is we all buy a UPS, we plug it in, we assume it's going to last forever. 5 years downrange, we don't worry about the battery. The battery's been sitting there cooking for years on end, and when it comes to a gel cell battery or a NiCad battery or a liquid nickel metal hydride or whatever kind of battery, lithium battery, there is an art and science required to properly charging a battery in such a way that it's near peak charge without overcharging, without undercharging, without cooking it, without artificially aging it. There's a whole art and science to that. For instance, a zillion years ago when Texas Instruments first came out with a handheld calculator, they had, in my opinion, the world's worst battery charger. It would cook the living daylights out of NiCad batteries. It could kill a set of NiCad batteries in about 3 months, 2 months, which is ridiculous. Hewlett-Packard, by comparison, had a three-wire charger as opposed to a two-wire charger, and it really controlled the voltage and current that was going into the NiCads, and they lasted a hell of a lot longer. Motorola had some early experience with on-the-wall chargers for their handy talkies that were cooking the daylights out of batteries and artificially aging them. The bottom line of all this, let me drop, is that gel cell battery that's in your UPS, had it been treated correctly with the right kind of the so-called float voltage charge, current-controlled float charge, I think that gel cell battery should last a good number of years, and 5 years downrange, if it's been treated correctly, it is my belief that gel cell battery could still give you 80% of capacity. However, if your particular UPS is not treating that gel cell battery correctly, you could easily be 5 years downrange when you've got 5% of the capacity of that gel cell battery. As such, if we're really smart, let me drop. When you've got a UPS that's more than a year old, I just picked that number out of the air, it would be nice to find out by one means or another, and now you've got to be careful, how much capacity does your gel cell battery pack have on your UPS? Is it good for 5 minutes, 50 minutes, or 155 minutes? You'd like to know. At first you'd say, okay, I'll unplug the input to the UPS, I'll let it run on its gel cell battery pack, and I'll run my computer. And yes, you could find out on that particular discharge how many ampere hours are left in that particular gel cell battery pack. But there's a catch. Depending on the design of your UPS, depending on how deep it will discharge that battery, you can now be damaging the battery. You take an ordinary lead-acid battery. Whenever you discharge it beyond 50%, you are doing damage, depending on how far you discharge it and how long you leave it there. You take a car battery and you make the mistake of leaving on the headlights and you let it stay that way all night long, and you come back the next morning and you just got a little bit of dim headlight with 3 volts coming out of the lead-acid battery, you're in a heap of trouble. Yes, you can recharge that battery, but for the rest of its life, it's going to be very low in ampere hours because of what you've just done. When you buy a so-called deep discharge marine type lead acid battery, they are better at this, but still there's some of that problem left. So I guess the only way you can really find out how good is the gel cell battery pack in your UPS, this is a speculation on my part, let me drop, is by one means or another, you monitor the voltage on the gel cell battery pack while it is running in the active mode into your computer as a normal load, for instance. And when the gel cell battery pack gets down to, let me pick a number, 11.9 volts, you stop the test. You don't discharge the gel cell battery all the way to ground. If you do, you're doing damage. So it's not an easy test to find out in a non-destructive manner how many ampere hours is left in your particular gel cell battery pack that's part of your UPS. Bunch of speculations on my part. You seem to have quite a bit of experience in this area, Scott, so please correct me. Victor Echo 3, Zulu Tech Tango Zulu, KQLAW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Vic. This is Scott in Toronto, E3ZTZ returning. I I'm in the IT field, and I do data center work. So I'm used to keeping large computer fields up and running. If I may, sir, I know my friend Jim here has been trying to get in with a solution to the chattering problem without having to go to, it sounds like without having to go to the online UPS. I'd like to defer to him if that's okay with you. VE3ZTZ back to net control.
Very fine, Scott. Jim, you got it. Victor Echo 3, Juliet India Mike. Juliet India Whiskey, sorry about that. Give a long enough delay and K2RW. Go right ahead, Jim.
Okay, thank you, Scott. VE3 Juliet India Whiskey. No, I don't know how to stop the UPS chattering. I went approached differently. I went out in search of a UPS that I think that would have a thousand VA, because I would figure I'll run at half of that. My load would be a TV stereo computer, so I'll be about 500 of its 1,000. So I'm going to run the unit at 50%. It came with 12-volt, 10-ampere-hour batteries, a pair of them, or four, sixes, whatever, 24 volts, 10 ampere hours. You only got 240 watt hours in the unit. That's not enough. 55 ampere hour batteries externally to the box. I used to use an external 24 volt supply. It went up in smoke. My last outage was an Elinco 330MV amateur radio supply. Hooked on to just charge a 12-volt battery, a different supply charging the other 12-volt battery. Most of your amateur stuff, like the Elinco, the negative battery and the ground plug that goes normally in the wall are common. You may want to stop the ground because you may have interesting issues with the grounding the batteries, that you can't have both chargers connected to the batteries and have the ground plugs connected, because the negative of the charger is connected to the ground of the power outlet. But if you need 24 volts, two amateur radio supplies. If you need 12 volts, drag your car battery, hook it up to UPS, or just put a really big external battery on. I'm going to trip and come back. Said gel cell. I think the word gel cell is a misnomer in a way. They're sealed lead acid. They're worth $10 or $15 for 7 ampere hour, which is often in 150, 250 VA type thing. But no, I externally charge the batteries. And by the way, the Elinco says do not use as a battery charger. They're right. If you hook up a 13.30 amp supply to a dead 12-volt battery, the amount of current that battery could take could be disastrous to the supply to your base